called to order the October meeting of the North Gateway Urban Renewal Advisory Board. Can we start by roll call, please?
All right. Gerard Robert Martin?
Here.
Mike Alley?
Here.
Bob Hank Resch?
It's Hank Resch, and I'm here.
Hank Resch, thank you, apologize. Nathan Levin? Pedro Mayorel?
Here.
Mark Adams?
Here.
And Dania Opine?
Here, and I just want to make an observation, Nate, when you said here, you were on mute.
Okay. Everybody's in.
All right, excellent.
Unmute.
There we go, hi.
Good morning.
Can I get an approval of the agenda for the October meeting? Can I get a motion, please? I'll go first, is there a second?
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, say nay. Approved. Can I get an approval of the minutes of the August meeting?
So moved.
Second?
I second, Pedro Mayorel.
Second by Pedro, all in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, nay. And approved. Did we have any public comment? I don't think we did we, sir?
I have not seen anything come through. Anita, Caleb, have you seen anything?
No, Anita's sending that agenda to Dania.
Agenda.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you guys, you didn't have any public comment come through to you, did you, Caleb?
No.
Okay, perfect, thank you.
You're
welcome. No public comment today.
Okay, excellent. Did we have new members, Sarah? Am I seeing new names, or is that just the people here to speak?
Nope, there's no new members.
Okay.
Yep, our membership runs through the end of December, so we will sadly be losing Barb. I know, she's terming out on us, but we can make a thing about it before she leaves, for sure. But no, it's all existing members or people that are here to speak.
Okay, and so I guess that's a good time to bring up. If anybody knows, we have two vacant positions on the board for residents of the urban renewal area that would be good to fill. And so if we're losing Barb, does that mean we're gonna have three?
Yes, she holds an at-large position. So that will become available in January. So that can be anybody. You don't have to be in the URA. And then it doesn't look like Brittany is on, but she reached out to me yesterday. She has taken a new position effective the end of December. And so she will also be leaving us at the end of December, and she holds a business/property owner. So if anybody knows, I was gonna do it at the end of the meeting, but since it came up now, if anyone knows of someone, business, property owner, at large, or resident, please urge them to apply between now and December, and then maybe we can just bring on board a whole group at once.
Excellent. We don't have any action items this month, so let's move on to 6A. Patricia is here from the Salem Climate Action Plan. Give us a little update. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Right.
Yes,
so I'll hand it off to you. You go ahead.
Okay, great. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for having me today for a presentation about the Climate Action Plan. I apologize if you've seen this already. I feel like I've given it to many different groups, but here it is. So hopefully you can see my screen. Yes? Okay. All right. So the Salem Climate Action Plan. We're kind of nearing the three-quarter mark on this plan. This plan is related to reducing our greenhouse gases. So this is a graph that shows where these emissions come from. They come from the burning of fossil fuels. So primarily you can see from transportation, there's some from electricity generation, stationary combustion is more like natural gas or diesel or propane. And then smaller amounts come from wastewater, which is in the form of methane. And then waste is actually from landfills, from gases, which is also methane, usually from landfills. So this kind of shows where our emissions come from. This is based on 2016 data. So it's a little bit out of date. For instance, this electricity amount is probably less now because PGE closed their Boardman plant, which was a coal-fired plant. So that amount of emissions has probably been reduced since this was done. But we're using this data as the basis for our plan. So in October of last year, City Council set these two goals. One is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 50% from those numbers I just showed you by 2035. And the next one is to become carbon neutral by 2050. So these are pretty ambitious goals, but it really helped to frame the work of the Climate Action Plan and look at actions that could help get us to meet these goals. Because transportation and energy are our main sources, there's going to be a lot of focus on those two items to reduce our emissions. So the Climate Action Plan, we began it last August, and we hired a consultant, Virtus Group, that's been assisting the city. And there's two components to it. One of it is the mitigation part, which is the one I just mentioned, which is really to focus on reducing our emissions. But then there's also another component to it, which is more related to adaptation or resilience building, because we're already facing impacts from climate change, and that's going to continue. So we want to be able to focus on some actions that can help build resilience in Salem. And then the other components of the plan are about being able to sort the actions that we come up with for implementation and to identify key partners, because the city, you know, only has so much under their purview. And a lot of things are going to depend on private businesses, key partners like PGE and Salem Electric and Energy Trust of Oregon and groups like that. So we want to, and Chariots is a big partner. And so we want to identify those partners and make sure that we align with their own plans. One of the first things we did was set up a task force. It's 33 members from across the community. So we have, you know, the standard groups, you know, Chamber of Commerce and Home Builders Association, but then we also really try to reach different groups that are impacted by climate change. So low income, people living with disabilities, seniors, indigenous community, the Spanish speaking community, social justice, things like that. So you can see on the list, we have quite a selection across the city of different groups represented on the task force. And we had 5 meetings. We have a 6th one coming up at the end of October. And all of the meetings have been on Zoom because we've been in COVID pandemic time, the entire process. It's actually worked out pretty well on Zoom, probably less discussion than if it had been in person. We also have 3 city councilors on it so that they can convey information back to the council and also be aware of concerns that come up as we're having our task force meetings. All of the meetings are live streamed and also recorded, so you can go to the website and watch them later if you're interested. So one of the things we did in the beginning of the Climate Action Plan was to assess Salem's vulnerability to climate change. And what was determined was that we are going to be affected or are affected by these different impacts. And so that's kind of the resilience side of the equation. The other thing to note here is that, you know, these are not experienced equally across the community. For instance, people who work outside and need to go to work, if there's bad air quality, you know, there or heat, we noted, you know, that happened this last summer. I mean, people actually died from heat stroke working outside. And then so there's other issues, people who are homeless, living outside, so that it's not experienced equally across the community. So both sides of the hydrology equation can be expected. more intense flooding, maybe flooding in different areas that didn't used to flood, which can lead to other issues such as property damage and health issues. And then also the flip side of that is drought, which we are in a drought still right now in Oregon. And drought can lead to other problems such as water quality issues. Like we had the blue-green algae issue, that's sometimes related to warm water, which can happen in drought. So there's a lot of public health concerns associated with this. This is the most recent drought map of Oregon. You can just see that the entire state is in one level of drought or another this year. And sometimes in the West, these droughts can go on for many years. So that can affect food availability. For instance, the price of different products can increase because of drought. One of the things I just heard recently was that grass seed, it has become really expensive because there was a lot of impacts to that. So that obviously affects the state and other businesses. The other issues, which we're all very aware of, is wildfire. This photograph is actually from last year when the smoke was blowing our direction. But the number of days where we're going to have high fire danger is going to increase. And smoke obviously can come from all sorts of different places and affect the air quality and public health as well. And then warming temperatures, you know, the average summer temperature is going to increase. We're going to have more days of what's called excessive heat, which is anything over 90 degrees. I think last time I checked, we had already like over 20 some days of days over 90 degrees this summer, some over 100 degrees. And we know that people can die from heat stroke and excessive heat. And a lot of times they're people that are seniors, people who can't afford air conditioners, and things like that. So there's a lot of kind of social issues related to these impacts. Another thing is the urban heat island effect, which is where heat builds up in the city, in areas that have a lot of impervious or surfaces such as buildings and roads, not a lot of trees. And so that can affect the livability of the city. Areas with more development will hold that heat longer and then release it at night. And so you don't even get the cooling effect of nighttime cooling off. And so that can lead to kind of long-term impacts for people living in those areas. It's also related to tree canopy. And so just, this doesn't show the tree canopy, but basically areas that are showing red or yellow or orange are areas also that have lower tree canopy and higher impervious areas. So you can see, for instance, the airport, you know, is the most extreme example right there, because obviously it has a lot of impervious or just short grass and no trees. But you can also see along the major corridors of Lancaster and Portland Road that there's a lot of heat island effect in those areas. So that's something to be aware of and something we're working on with our tree canopy work in the city. Here's just some of the economic impacts that can happen because of some of those other impacts I just talked about. So, you know, things that if there's flooding, if there's fire, obviously there's going to be disruptions to transportation. There's going to be public health, which might affect workforce availability, supply chain. You know, then there's also the energy grid, which I know is a lot of concern, because if more people go to electricity, and there's a lot of demand in a really hot day, you know, is the grid capable of sustaining power? And then there's impacts to other things such as tourism, outdoor recreation, which Oregon depends on a lot. And then I mentioned water supply, just if there's a drought or if there's infrastructure damage somehow related to flooding. And then there's going to be more insurance claims as some of these things happen as well. So there's a whole myriad of potential economic impacts. So in the Climate Action Plan, through public engagement and meetings such as this and our task force, we've come up, and our consultants, we've come up with a whole list of different strategies, and they're in these kind of seven buckets of ideas. A lot of them are under transportation and energy, but we also have ideas for material and waste, because a lot of the composting and the disposal of waste increases our greenhouse gases. But then there's also things more related to the resilience side of things, which is more the natural resources and under this community. This is a lot about equity. And then we're also focusing on food and economic development so that we make sure that we are balancing, you know, impacts to different groups with potentially with some ideas for how to help and incentives and support as we move forward. So if you go to the website, you're going to find a chart, a spreadsheet that looks something like this. This is a little bit old. We've been, I think we're on version 20 now. This might be version 17 here. But basically, they're grouped into those seven categories. There's a vision statement, there's an equity statement, and then each of the strategies also has a ranking according to the potential to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions, a very rough, you know, qualitative cost. Who's the lead agency, co-benefits, and then a kind of a rough estimate of timeline of when this could possibly or should be implemented. So there's a lot of information, and the reason we did it this way is that therefore we can sort on the Excel spreadsheet. We can look at all the ones that are city.
Hey Patricia, yeah, let me jump in real quick. Mark, can you mute your mic, please? Thank you. We're still. Yeah, you still need to mute.
I did mute.
Mute your computer and your phone because you're logged in on both, I think.
I think I did. I just turned the.
There we go. We're good now. Thank you.
Okay, the spaceship has landed. So anyway, we can sort this table anyway. So we can sort by if the city is the lead agency, if it has high greenhouse gas reduction potential, and this will help us determine the implementation strategy. So where we are in the process is, as I mentioned, kind of nearing the end of this. We're in doing a lot of meetings with different groups over the summer. We're doing boards and commissions. Right now, we had a work session with City Council on the 20th, and we have our final task force workshop on October 27th. And then the goal is to take this to City Council December 6th. There's also going to be very soon the public release of the draft plan. And so if people are interested, they can go to the website and it will be posted there. It'll be open for public comment this period of time until November 5th. And then we're going to take all the comments and go through the report and refine it and update it. And then that will be the one that goes to council. So there's still some revisions happening that will be happening in the near future. So keep an eye open for that if you're interested. And here's where you can go to get all this information, SalemClimateActionPlan.com. And there's a wealth of information there. So feel free to go and browse and see if there's anything that you think we're missing. We're happy to take new suggestions as we're refining this plan. So with that, I will take any questions.
Well, thanks, Patricia. Anybody have any questions? No questions. How long have you guys been working on this, Patricia?
Started last August, so a little over a year.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. No questions or no other ideas to add? I did add one from the West Salem group, which I know has maybe more large, they had some large food processors there. And so, you know, one of the things we're really focusing on is trying to get people to switch to electric. And so to maybe wean off of natural gas, if possible, and of course, big push towards electric vehicles. And so we want to try to incentivize that or to make that as painless as possible so that we can try to meet our goals. So I know that sometimes that raises some concerns with people who are dependent on natural gas right now.
Okay. This is Mark. I do have a question. Has there been any discussion of dredging the Willamette River to make it deeper so the water could be cooler and not be as warm as it currently is?
No, that we haven't. That's not in the plan. Actually, that's somewhat of a controversial issue, as you can imagine. Yeah, I mean, there are cool areas actually, you know, kind of in shallow, gravelly areas sometimes. So it's not a simple matter of just dredging the whole river. And a lot of the water actually is regulated by the Corps of Engineer dams. And so the temperature is often related to their releases, and DEQ keeps a close eye on the temperature in the river. So that's all kind of a federal state process there.
Well, if one of the goals was to improve the recreation abilities, the river is not currently usable by boats. It is by kayaks and canoes, but, you know, I've been in this town for my entire life, and I know that there used to be quite a bit of activity around the river. You know, the boat ramp now is nothing but a sandbar. So I'm just curious if that was discussed at all.
Yeah, no, that particular one was not discussed. And recreation is not the focus necessarily. It's trying to reduce impacts from, you know, like wildfire smoke and things like that that affect recreation. So it's not recreation per se. So that one doesn't really kind of fit under the purview of the plan, I guess.
Great, thank you.
I mean, I understand your concern, though. I've heard that before because my other job is Parks and Natural Resources as planning manager.
Oh, okay. So yeah, you probably have heard of them. So.
Yeah, I hear that. I hear that frequently, actually.
Thank you.
So Patricia, you guys don't want people to use natural gas. I'm an electrician. Do you have a plan for where the power is going to come from if we go away from natural gas?
Well, PGE and Salem Electric, you know, Salem Electric gets their energy from green energy sources already. So they're getting most of it from hydro. So the dams on the Columbia River primarily. There's also a big push towards solar. PGE is going gangbusters on increasing solar right now. So solar farms, trying to get solar on new buildings. Of course, the issue right now, I think the big issue is kind of storage of solar because it takes big batteries right now. So they're definitely, PGE is working on that quite a bit on how to engage more solar and how to get it to people, maybe inside kind of microgrid access.
Yeah, okay. But isn't that going to make the power more expensive, which in turn will hurt the low-income community?
Well, there's a whole public utility commission, and they're very focused on making sure that those rates do not disproportionately affect low income. So there's a whole rate structure, and I'm way out of my wheelhouse here, but all of that, all the rate structures are set by the state and the feds.
Anyone else got any questions, comments?
Anybody have an electric vehicle?
Still running on gas.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak to your group. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you. All right, Sarah, what's happening? Any updates?
Well, before we go into updates, I think we have Kristen on today.
Oh.
So I was going to give her the chance to pop on if she wanted to say hello to the group since we had a little bit of time.
There we go. Good morning.
All right, Kristen.
Hi. I just wanted to say hi. I know we've got some new board members, and it's been quite a while since I've been on this. So I thought I'd join in today, see if what the updates are, if you have any questions for me, anything I can update you guys on. And other than that, just see your faces, because it's been a while.
Anyone got any questions? Comments?
You know, I will say to Mark's points earlier about activity on the river, I think a lot of that was because of impacts to the locks up at West Lynn, and they closed down the locks, so bigger boats can't get full access to the river now.
Well, actually, small boats can't use the river. It's too shallow. So it used to be you could go from Independence all the way up to Kaiser in a family boat, a ski boat, a small fishing boat, whatever you wanted. And it really was a lot of neat activity along the river there. It became a place where, when I was younger, it was a popular place to go. Now, people are displaced to go to places like Detroit Lake, yeah, which obviously has not been available lately.
So you
just can't run a propeller in 6 inches of water. It just doesn't work. And the fish are not coming back like they used to. So there's been changes, and a lot of it is stuff that's been washed down for years. And the process used to be that every so many years that would be dredged out to keep a cool channel running through the river that really was good for wildlife and for other activities. But that we don't do that anymore, and that's why I'd like to see us revisit that.
Well, I think the Port of Portland has been trying to get dredging, to get shipping tankers up the river for I don't know how many decades now. So I know it's not a fast process by any means at this point. All right, well, if nobody else has questions about anything, we'll let you go into your other updates.
Thanks, Kristen. Everyone's very quiet today. So I only have a couple updates. Obviously, we talked about the vacancies and kind of what we're seeing in terms of openings. So like I said, please have folks apply. The thing I'll throw out for the resident one is you don't have to live in North Gateway. You could be in North Gateway or within a close proximity. So, if you know someone and they're, within a close range, there isn't sort of a set boundary, have them go ahead and apply as well. We'd love to have more folks that are interested in what we do joining the board. Obviously, in-person meetings are still unknown for the time being, so we'll just be keeping to this format. I know you guys have asked in the past, and so we'll just keep on with Zoom until you hear different. Based on what we're seeing coming down the pipeline for meetings for the next couple of months, it's looking like we'll probably be able to condense November, December into one. Whether that's going to be November or December, I'm still working on. I should know more later this week, and then I'll be checking in with Jared at the beginning of next week as to which one it looks like that's going to be, but I think we'll be able to condense it into one for everybody's time. And I'm hopeful at one of those meetings, I should be able to provide everybody an update of kind of some of those larger CIP projects that we have in the budget, kind of what's going on with them. We budgeted for the left turn lane off of Silverton Road to 17th Street. And obviously we've got a few other projects kind of in the mix that we've been discussing, everything from the Pine Street extension to what's happening at the former Zamora site that's currently a micro shelter site. So I'm hopeful I can kind of just give everyone sort of a high level overview of what's happening there and how everything's kind of aligning as we move into the next calendar year. So that'll be coming up as well. And then if there's anything else anybody wants to hear about or wants on the agenda, just as a reminder, let myself or Jared know so we can be sure we're, managing everybody's expectations, because I'm sure there's lots of things happening in the community. And if you'd like somebody else to come in and provide an update, I'm more than happy to make sure we arrange that.
Do you have any update on the Zamora site where they put the shelters? Actually, I've been driven by there. Are they up and are they running in full?
Yes, they're up, they're running. I think there's, correct me if I'm wrong, Kristen, I want to say there's 20 of them on the site, and they're scheduled to be there until March, and that's tied to the DEQ condition only allowing someone to live on the site for 18 months. So that's why I'm kind of working with engineering and some other folks to kind of get some things moving so that we can figure out what's going to happen next in that whole area. So they're up, they're running, and I'm actually talking to Gretchen right now because I'm hopeful I can get her back to the board too to kind of talk to everyone about how things are going. Obviously, there's a second one going in just up on Portland Road. I think it's 32 Portland Road, I want to say.
Well, I haven't heard of that. 636.
up by where the Catholic Community Services office is, their warehouse.
Yeah. There's another micro shelter, supposedly, is going in.
In the back parking lot there? Is that where you're going to? It will be micro shelters. It won't be the warehouse itself.
They're exploring the warehouse also, but it requires some sprinkler improvement, so it may not pencil.
Okay.
I think they could only use it for a year.
Okay. Yeah, I drive by daily, the one on the Zamora side, and they've done a nice job of putting up banners, you know, to keep the public view from being pretty obvious. There's a lot of RVs and trailers and things in there along with the shelters, Jared, just so you'll know. So it seems to be full every day, and I don't see any people hanging around outside the fenced area. Everybody seems to be inside, and you know, it's not as ugly as some of the other stuff we've seen around town, so I guess my hat's off to them for doing a good job of keeping that site as organized and clean as they can.
That's good to hear. I know I've had a couple friends hit me up that are from West Salem, where they're putting in the one out in West Salem.
Yep. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, there's always concerns, you know, when you, and it'll be, you know, as long as it's managed well, I think that's the key. But that's a tough population to manage. We've discussed that and found that for years. They don't want to be managed, just like herding cats. So that's going to be tough.
Yeah. Anything else, Sarah?
That is all I have for this meeting, unless somebody has anything else that they want to ask me.
Anyone? Well, hey, quick meeting. Good meeting. Thanks for the updates, everyone. And okay. I guess we will... Hey.
I have a delay on my computer here, and for whatever reason, I didn't get an answer fast enough when Sarah asked the question. I actually happen to live literally two blocks away from the camp they just cleared at the intersection of Lancaster and Portland Road, and am seeing the effect of the issues with the neighboring people having my mail stolen and such, and I'm a little concerned that the rules keep changing, and quite frankly, from a resident perspective still, that it's not getting any better. It's actually getting worse. And while I appreciate that there is a site on the Zamora property, and I appreciate that there is a deadline of when that's going to cease, I'm frustrated by the fact that the rules keep changing, people keep moving, camps keep getting relocated in different places, and I'm curious from the city perspective of the actual cost all of this is, because we're finding temporary solutions to place people or move people. I'm actually watching crime statistics. I'm getting ready to move to Yamhill County, and so I haven't seen the actual Marion County numbers. But the effect of how many people who are desperately in trouble, who are committing crimes, getting themselves placed in jail, so they at least have a place to stay. And I guess I want to emphasize the point that I hope that there's some work being done for permanent solutions in terms of permanent housing, permanent subsidized services, or whatever it might be, because this constant shifting of people across neighborhoods, I think in the long run, and I don't have proof of it, is actually gonna cost us a lot more than actually just dealing with the problem. I'm expressing an opinion, so I appreciate the indulgence of the board to do that, because it's absolutely affecting my livability along Portland Road and what I expected this this corridor to be as far as a business district, so to speak. Thank you.
Sarah, would you like me to address that? But because I also
I will let you jump right in.
Okay. All right. So there are a number of initiatives that the city has had underway for about the past 3.5, maybe 4 years. One was the investment in Redwood Crossings out on Fisher Road, which is a property that we purchased in part using funding from this urban renewal area and also community development block grant funds. This is a housing authority property that has over 30, I think we're at 36 spaces there that has had a homeless preference where we've been housing people in. That came online about a year and a half ago. We have two other projects in the works. One is the Aquinnah Hall, which will be on the campus of the old state hospital, and that will be 52 units. That project has been delayed and delayed and delayed. We started that in 2017, but we're purchasing it from the state, and the state was very delayed in getting the petition done for us to purchase that property. We're closing on that property in November. Improvements will start for the renovations in probably January. So that'll be 52 more units with also a homeless preference, and that also will target individuals with serious mental illness. We have another project in development that will be out on kind of Broadway off of the Parkway called Sequoia Crossings that we got some state funding from about 9 months ago that's in project development right now. You know, what we're finding with some of our affordable housing projects is because of the pandemic and supply chain costs are going through the roof. Anybody that's in construction is seeing that. Those impacts have left us with about a $2.5 million gap for that project that we're working to fill. We're seeking additional state funding for that project, but that'll be another 72 units, and that will be a permanent supportive housing project. So that will, you know, have the homeless preference with wraparound services for individuals. We've taken some of our federal money for COVID and purchased a building out off of Mission Street in 22nd for a navigation center that we'll be partnering with Arches on. So we've completed that acquisition. We've got a lot of renovations to do because we need to sprinkler the building and basically prepare it for shelter use, put in a kitchen, showers, those sorts of things. So we can have about another 50 individuals there. That will be as a navigation center that provides shelter, and it's sort of that transition to help people from being in the camp or on a street to prepare to move into an apartment. Because what we found, like out at Redwood Crossings, we have a lot of people that they're not used to living in environments where there's accountability or property management, you know, where there's an expectation of behavioral modifications, right? So the navigation center is a part of that continuum to help people start to stabilize and prepare to move into permanent housing. So we're hoping that we can have all the renovations done and that online in the spring. We have also funded partnerships with Church at the Park to do pallet shelters or car camps in other locations around the city. We've had our housing rental assistance program that's funded directly out of the city's general fund up and running for a little over 3 years now. And that program prioritizes the hardest to house that have either been longer term homeless, have serious mental illness or physical illness to get them into housing. And that, you know, that we also provide case management for that, and Arches helps provide with case management for that as well. We've housed, I think, around 300 folks now with that program. So there is a lot that the city is doing to try to bring on shelter capacity or camping capacity or permanent housing in locations around the city. And we've invested millions of dollars in doing that. Some of the challenges, though, are that Oregon has the lowest number of inpatient mental health beds in the nation. And a large percentage of the homeless population that we have in Salem have mental health and addiction issues. And they need more assistance than is available in our state. you know, so the city is more and more taking on these sort of social service efforts to help those individuals that really need greater degrees of care or assistance than we're either funded or staffed or able to provide. You know, so additionally, we're working with our elected officials to see if, and this is gonna be a focus of our upcoming legislative session, it's very difficult for the private sector to develop mental health housing or inpatient care in Oregon. There's been a facility in Wilsonville that has been trying to go into Wilsonville for 7 or 8 years now, and they're still having challenges getting through the approval process. We have been approached by others from out of state looking to do this in Oregon and said, no, it's too difficult to do it here. So that is another challenge that's, you know, far beyond what the city can do. And then the other thing, when you talk about seeing an uptick in this last year, that's the result of a couple of things. One is that we had a long period of time where jails were not holding people for property crimes, only violent crimes. And so that has led to some changes in behavior in the community and with this population. And then additionally, we have seen an increase in individuals coming into Oregon from out of state over the last 9 months or so, coinciding with the decriminalization of harder drugs. So we've seen that a lot with those that are in kind of the car camping community or camping in parks or on streets in vehicles. There's definitely been an uptick of out-of-state folks in the last 9 months. So, you know, kind of all of that's the whole, I mean, all of those things interplay. It's all an ecosystem. There's not like one thing that you can do to solve the problem, but we've had a growth and influx of people as part of that part of our population and part of our community. As we're still, you know, trying to add more resources, add more bed capacity, add more housing units. You know, we've also done things like try to be really innovative in our partnerships with the private sector. We created a single property urban renewal area out on the state campus in partnership with Neighborly Ventures. They're building a market rate housing, multifamily housing project there. And through that single property urban renewal area, we are able to incentivize affordable units within that development by offering a partial property. So we're going to get 15% of the units in that development. I think I froze that.
You did, but we can hear you still. Or maybe not. Jared, you're on mute still.
Oh,
Kristen's back.
Right, there we go.
I'm back. She's back. Okay. She's on for.
You there, Kristen?
Yep, I'm here. And did you have a question, Jared?
Yeah. So it's the whole state knows that it's a problem that we don't have any beds for mentally ill people. Are the cities going to the state and saying, hey, we need to open something, and maybe they need to change what's holding up all these companies from coming here and opening up beds?
Yeah, that's something that is of a lot of interest to the mayor, and something that we're going to be pushing during this upcoming legislative session.
Anyone have any questions for Kristen?
I would like to ask a question.
Go ahead, Nick.
Kristen, on a couple of comments or side comments you made during your discussion, you mentioned the difficulty in getting approvals to proceed with a particular project. I will tell you that because of the city's goofy rules and criteria, that it's a challenge to do anything, whether it's commercial industrial project, a residential project, or have you, as you have noted, needed homeless projects because of the city's zone code, planning requirements, etc. Until the city of Salem starts making some changes to become more friendly, cooperative, or even, I hate to say the word, reasonable in the process, ain't nothing gonna happen.
Thanks, Nate.
I also have a kind of a follow-up comment and maybe just a clarification. Kristen, thank you for talking through the plan for in discussion regarding beds. I personally worked with Oregon State Hospital for 8 years before I left there. I still work for state service. When I left, I was a policy analyst trying to figure out the red tape between inpatient services to transitioning to outpatient services. And one of the things I think it would be helpful from a communication standpoint going forward is to emphasize what, when you talk about a lack of beds, that you, I believe what you're trying to say is that there is a lack of outpatient beds. From a matter of mental health activities, locking somebody up in a hospital for however long because they need housing is not the answer for somebody with mental illness. Inpatient services in a hospital doesn't fit for the need. What is needed is outpatient beds, community services, keeping people in the community. Overall cost, it's much more effective to deal with somebody while they're in their own environment than it is to even attempt emergency services in a hospital. So I would encourage you to change that communication to focus on community beds or outpatient beds, because I think you're going to get a very, very hard sell for anybody trying to open up a new hospital here in Oregon.
So what we have found in our outpatient sort of situation, like Redwood Crossings, where we have permanent supportive housing and case management and wraparound services, is it's not enough. It's not enough care, it's not enough support. The need levels are higher than that. And we are finding that a lot of people that go into that environment, they're not stabilizing. We've had individuals that have then returned to camp environments because they've not been able to stabilize in that environment with the wraparound services. And so, you know, I don't know that it's necessarily a hospital environment that is needed, but definitely an environment where there's just more than the periodic case managers that check in, you know, once a day or every couple of days. So we do, there's a gap there in terms of the need level.
This is Mark. So you're saying that there's a need for, I call them structured living environments. But the level of structure is really the issue. You know, how much support is there at what levels is kind of the issue. So we maybe, you know, the big picture is we've got to kind of rethink considering the, you know, the product we've got to deal with today. We've got to rethink the processes that we're going through. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think that that's true. I think that back in the 80s when we started with the deinstitutionalization, there was the plan was that more of this the needs would be met at the community level. Like, is it Dania or Dania?
My name is Dania. Thank you.
Dania. Okay, but Dania is referring to where with the outpatient beds, and there the funding for those programs, the capacity within that system is not robust enough to meet that need. So, you know, we've got individuals in the community that probably should be at the state hospital or have been, and they cycle through. You know, we see them pretty frequently in the downtown environment. Our officers know them. They know that, you know, they've been recently, you know, they've left the state system and then they're back on the streets, and there is not a good in-between place for people to go so that they can remain stabilized. We've had people, you know, on the streets, you know, that Rite Aid area downtown, where we have case managers that go by constantly to try to interact with people who are not capable of having a conversation with a case manager or making choices about where to go or to accept assistance. I mean, they just can't have a coherent conversation with them.
Yeah, I work across the street from Rite Aid, so I know it very well. I've dealt with a lot of the individuals there that are on the street, and they've been displaced currently, which is nice, but I know that's temporary, and I know that's not a fix. So yeah, I appreciate all your efforts. I appreciate your insight and knowledge. You know, like I said, I've been a resident here my whole life, so we lived through the 80s when the institutions were closed, and they were literally dumped onto the downtown core. The old houses became group homes, as they called them, and there was no structure to really monitor those, and it became a fiasco. So we're dealing with the fallout from those decisions, and we're going to have to rebuild, and I think that's what you're in the process of doing right now.
Yeah, and projects like, you know, the Redwood Crossings, Sequoia Crossings are very important. They need much more mental health support in terms of case management than we currently have out at Redwood Crossings, or that we have resources for in the community. It's becoming more and more challenging to find people who want to be case managers or who have that experience.
There was a law in the 80s, excuse me, there was a law in the 80s, I maybe called the Rebecca Law or something, that said basically if someone was released from an institution, whether it was a mental health or penitentiary, they had to go back to their original home county. So these are not all Salemites. So is there any process where we relocate people back home to let those communities deal with them? It sounds terrible to say that we're, you know, going to throw it off on someone else, but they didn't start here. They just ended up here. So is there a process for that?
I don't know the answer to that question, Mark.
Okay.
And Kristen, thank you for the talk through. I know I've asked some very pointed questions, so I apologize if there's tone in part of what I'm asking. It's a very, very, very complicated project. In response to the person who's talking before me, I can't see your name, I apologize. There are other states, as part of their strategy to deal with their money issues, their problems in their own state, who openly give people bus tickets to go wherever they feel like going. And because we do have friendly environments for this thing, we happen to see a lot of people coming to Oregon because they can make it through a winter without dying out on the street. In some places, you know, such as Wyoming, which I also served, people will literally die on the street in Wyoming, and they were one of the places that did issue bus tickets to send people anywhere that they wanted to go. Thank you for all the work that you guys are doing. It's a very complicated project. There's not enough money in the world to deal with things, and there's no one right answer. So I do sincerely appreciate the analysis of what's working at Redwood Crossings and places like that. I don't know if that was done through part of past grant services or not, but the whole concept of creating a structure, making people develop new habits, and get into a new routine of living, and identifying what additional services they need to be successful. It sounds like that is an appropriate method, but a good ask to find out what's still missing to help those people be successful. So thank you for the talk through.
You're welcome, and I think that when the Navigation Center opens next spring, that's going to be a very important, filling a very important gap that we have right now to help people further stabilize before they move into a place like Sequoia Crossings or Redwood Crossings. Any other questions?
Well, thanks, Kristen. You're here. It was a good conversation. And I think everyone appreciates what you guys are trying to do. I know it's a real hard task dealing with the whole issue. So we do appreciate it. Anyone have anything else? Well, we will follow up with all you guys after I talk to Sarah about if we're going to do November or December. And then when do we start budget talks again?
So we will start talking about the draft budget in February. Typically we receive a draft budget to discuss, and then the final one comes back in March for us to make a recommendation on. And then we typically don't have a January meeting just because it always falls right around New Year's and folks are, you know, busy hopefully doing fun family things.
I got one more question. Is there a lot of people coming in for the grants at all right now?
So I'm working with Tori right now on a grant update. We've had a couple new ones come in. We've had a few that had been sort of continued just due to circumstances. As everybody knows, things are taking a little bit longer, getting, you know, products is taking longer. And so a few of those have finally started moving again. We do have funds still available, but we are sort of getting that slow trickle, kind of what we used to see. But we haven't had some large, you know, everyone's just jumping in to get the funds. So if folks are interested, or you know folks are interested, we do still have money available. But Tori and I are actually working on an update right now that we'll be bringing back to the board. And then one of the things I'm also working on updating for the board is a couple of years back, one of the things that everyone had asked for was kind of a visual representation of where we've put those grant funds within the URA. And with COVID, we didn't have a lot of activity, but now that we're seeing some activity again, I'm going to go back in and kind of update that just so everyone can see where we've sort of put funds over the last handful of years geographically.
All right, well, thanks everybody for being here, and we will see you either November or December. Meeting adjourned.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.